Welcome to the Kinda Okay podcast, where we talk about things that aren't okay in hopes of making things feel more okay. I'm Sarah Crossley, creator of It's Kinda Okay Comics and the Growing Pains zine, an independent publication made by rad women and non-binary creatives all over the world who supply awesome content, usually theme-based. Issue 8 is currently calling for submissions from artists, writers, photographers, journalists, interviewers, interviewees, all of that in relation to the theme of unlearning. So if you want to submit some content or have an idea of who might be a good interviewee for the next issue of the zine, head on over to itskindaokay.com and contact me there. I want to take a moment at the start of this episode to thank all of the patrons over on Patreon at patreon.com/kindaokay. You guys really help keep me motivated to keep creating, and it's just nice to know that somebody's listening, so that's why I keep recording, even if there's only a few of you. I really love being able to share these conversations that are so honest and vulnerable and open, and hopefully encourage you to have more conversations like this in your life as well. Okay, on with the podcast. I feel so lucky to have so many incredible human beings in my life that have influenced my direction of my art and creativity. The person I'm speaking with today is one of my biggest inspirations in how I want to live my life and coexist with art, music, and loved ones. Jim Elliott, or Jimmy Tooties as we call him, is an analog animator, musical wizard, and unbelievable mixologist. Him and his partner Rosie run Digital Dropout Media, and just so happened to be a pair of the most beautiful souls on the planet. Hi, Jim.
Oh, hi, what a nice thing to say. Thank you very much.
Welcome. Thank you for being here and for taking time and being present to have this chat. It's lovely to have you here.
It's great. I've listened to a few of the podcasts and I really like what you're doing. It's great.
Oh, thanks. What's kind of okay for you today?
What's kind of okay? The weather's jolly okay. It's nice and warm. And I'm very lucky at the moment. I'm just coming to the end of an animation project with our local organisation for carers. So people who are either young carers or providing sort of long-term care for a partner, or some people doing end-of-life care and parents and siblings who are looking after other siblings. And of course they're all a bit isolated at the moment, so we've had this big project to record or get them to send in recordings of themselves, and then I've been animating them, and it's
wow.
Been an absolute privilege. Yeah, it's really good fun. They're some incredible people, and I've never met them, I've never seen them, because I just get sent the audio file, so I have to sort of build a picture in my head of what they might look like. And then animate them. Sometimes it's hopelessly wrong, it's quite nice in a way to be that kind of, to not make a judgment on somebody, just to hear their voice. And a lot of them as well, they're quite sort of sensitive. The information that they're giving out is not private as such, but it's sensitive, and you know, if you can anonymize it in a creative way, that's really nice. So I'm feeling very lucky to have that work at the moment. It's really good.
That sounds like something really cool to be a part of.
It's lovely. It's really lovely.
Can you tell us a little bit in your own words about what you do in general?
So for my job, I am an animator, and I do real world animation. So I have in the past worked a lot with plasticine and clay. But more recently, I've been trying to move away from that because, however you look at it, plasticine and clay is single-use plastic, really. and I was getting through about 25 kilograms of it a month, which when you weigh it up is a lot of landfill. So I've moved into paper, and I try and do as much as I possibly can to just cut out paper and glue. So everything we do at the end of the day can just be recycled, which is feels a lot nicer, really. And it has a look that's really sort of interesting to me. So that's my main job. Most of what I do is actually working with other people. So other people do the animation and I help them along. But at the moment, that's very difficult because we're all in lockdown. So it's mainly sort of me doing the animation, which I'm getting my head around. It's unusual for me. And then in my spare time, I play a lot of music. I'm in various bands, do some sort of a peculiar one-man band setup, which is good fun. I like doing that a lot and is ideal for these times. and also, I make drinks. I mix cocktails mainly for just me and Rosie at the moment, but occasionally we have other people. We've just set up a window into our back garden with a table just outside it, so that people can come around and have socially distanced cocktails. So they sit outside, we sit inside, we're 2 meters apart, but we can serve them drinks kind of two at a time. So
that's incredible.
It's lovely. Yeah, it's a really nice thing.
What a nice little like lockdown hack.
Exactly. Yeah. A little speakeasy.
Yeah. I've been really loving the Vicarious cocktail bar.
That's been really good fun, just to try and keep my hand in partly, but also to just sort of keep the name alive, because I had been, just before the world went peculiar, I had been running sort of two or three cocktail nights a month in various locations, and it was starting to build into something really good fun. And so I just wanted to make sure that didn't completely grind to a halt. So the Vicarious cocktail bar was born. So people.
Lovely to see like so many people taking pictures of their cocktails or making cocktails and, you know, like learning at the same time as getting a nice drink.
There's a couple of people who've really gotten into the spirit of it, and they make the drinks, they post the pictures, and they leave a review. It's really nice. I think we've become a fixture in people's social calendars. If they can't go out, but they can make the drinks themselves at home, it's been lovely, really good fun.
I really enjoyed too because you've combined a lot of the elements of what you do into the cocktails as well. I remember, you know, you had some paper animations of the first couple mixed drinks, and
that's true. Yeah,
is the music yours as well?
Sadly not. No. Oh, okay. I would love for it to be mine, but no, that's all library music.
Gotcha.
Yeah
fair enough. Oh, cool. I just think that it's so incredible and inspiring to see like everything that you create, because it's all got it's got like the essence of you in it, and it really comes through in your style and everything that you do. And I just think it's absolutely incredible, and it's constantly inspiring me to try different things. So I'm really grateful for all that you put your heart and soul into.
Gosh, that is a lovely thing to say. It's very interesting to hear you say it, because I think Rosie and me and Bess and Nancy, my kids, I think they all find what you do quite inspiring as well. And especially the time we spent with you and Tom a couple of years ago really gave us all a bit of a lift, I think, in terms of just, I forget what you called it, but the thing where you had to draw your demons and you did a little book with pictures of you. We all had to do a picture of us confronting our demons, and that was a really lovely thing. We all did it, and I think we all sort of came away from that thinking, actually, we are kind of creative people, and it was lovely to just have that value placed on it. Do you know what I mean? It was a small thing, but it was a lovely thing, really lovely thing.
Oh, I'm so glad that it resonated and meant so much. And yeah, it's so cool to see, because you guys all have such different styles. You've all got, you know, very, very different expressions of yourselves. And I think that that's incredible, because so often I think families and relationships and partners and stuff, you know, the we can get a little overlapped, and, you know, and it's cool to see you're still all so distinct from each other. And it's just incredible.
I think we all come from sort of different places. Rosie and I met at university, where we were both doing slightly the same degree, but she was doing the drama side and I was doing the music side. So we've always had that kind of, there are things that we're good at that the other one isn't, if you know what I mean. There's things that Rosie has an incredible aesthetic eye, whereas I'm possibly slightly more constructive constructant, but, you know, I will build things, whereas she will draw or paint things that are just beautiful. Mm-hmm. And then Bess and Nancy, I guess they do their own thing their own way, and they do it very, very well. They each have their own personalities, and yeah, obviously I'm a big fan of them both, but yeah, in their creative styles as well. But they do music, they do art, they do animation, they do all the things that we do, but in their own way.
That's just incredible. Where did your love of music come from?
I assume probably from my parents. I mean, my mum taught me to play the recorder before I went to school. So she's always played the recorder. And I can remember being sort of, it's possible I wasn't quite old enough to read, but she had flashcards with notes on, and she would hold up the flashcard and it had the note written on the stave, but then also the finger positions for the recorder and the name of the note. So she would hold them up and have to play that note, and then she'd hold up another one and play that note. And I remember doing that when I was very, very, very young. And then my dad always had music on, really. We used to do quite a lot of driving together, and he always had a good stereo in his car and would sort of blast out all kinds of things, early Trojan and, you know, really interesting sort of prog rocky. So he'd hate it if I said prog rock, but, you know, sort of rock, but kind of intelligent rock, let's say that. And we would sing along at the top of our voices when no one else could hear. And it was just all I wanted to do. I was given my first toy guitar when I was really, really small. And then I was given my first real guitar when I was about 6. And I had guitar lessons. My first guitar teacher was a nun.
Wow.
And she taught me to play sort of various things. And then I was lucky that my mum sort of saw the value in that, and she paid for me to have guitar lessons, even when we had very little. You know, we had nothing, but she made sure that every week I had this guitar lesson, and right up until I left school, I had a guitar lesson every week, no matter what. And I loved it. It was my only hobby. It was the only thing I wanted to do. I would come home from school, pick up the guitar. I would watch telly, but I would be playing guitar and watching telly for 4 hours a day. It's just all I wanted to do. I've always loved playing and making music, and there's a joy in that that just I don't think you get anywhere else, really.
That sounds like such a wonderful supportive foundation for a love of music that, you know.
Can you hear that?
Yeah, the woo woos in the background.
I might just have to. You're right.
No, it's okay. It's really, it's lovely.
You want to say?
You all right? It's all right. I'm being interviewed. I'm about to see Sarah. Yeah, come in.
I'm being interviewed for Sarah's podcast that I've talked about.
Here's the part of the podcast where I want to remind you that if you like what you're hearing, other people might too. So wherever you listen to podcasts, please go and leave a review, because it can really help other beings find these awesome conversations. And if you really like what you're hearing, you'll probably like what you see over at patreon.com/kindaok, whether it's comics, drawing videos, new t-shirt designs, all that kind of good stuff available for patrons over there. And if you want to grab access to the Growing Pain zine, all of the issues are available online to print at home at itskindaokay.com. Okay, on with the interview.
Right. Very important ice cream business. Great.
It's lovely. It's just so nostalgic. Like, so the Woo Whoops are really cool. My parents have recently gotten a dog.
Right.
And they play hide and seek with him.
Oh, nice.
And when he can't find them, they do a woo whoop. So it's funny because it's, and Tom and I do it all the time whenever we come into the house. And it's just so funny because it's really carried through into everybody's lives that have interacted with you.
It's such a useful thing.
It's so good.
In a crowd, and it can be in a really crowded, noisy place. It cuts through and you know, oh, yeah, right, yeah.
Yeah.
It's great. It's a fine thing.
Lovely. Yeah. So it sounds like you had a really supportive and, you know, loving foundation to learn the initial skills of music that would then translate into all of the instruments you play. You play a lot of instruments.
I can wrestle a tune out of most instruments. I'm not sort of a virtuoso in anything, but I can play most things to a point where I can be happy. I know what it is. I can express whatever I'm feeling with whatever instrument I've got enough, if you see what I mean, to just make it make emotional sense. I wouldn't claim any technical skill or anything, but I do genuinely mean every note I play, if you see what I mean. I've been doing some recording recently, sort of semi-session work, but I hope it's slightly more than that. So I've been given, I've been sent through the recordings of this song, and then being asked to just do something to it, to just play something on it or play some things on it. And so far, I mean, I've put down sort of hand bells, I've done singing, I've done guitars, I've put flute on it, harmonica, all synths, bass, all kinds of stuff. And then the producer just takes it away and makes it sound amazing. But I think he's happy because he's had a history of sort of very good technical players and it all sounds a bit cold. Whereas I hope what I'm doing sounds authentic.
That's really lovely.
But I feel that I really do have to give my mum proper credit for like you say, it was a very supportive environment. And she had that belief in the value of music, and just from an emotional point of view and everything else. I know that when she was a kid, she was offered ballet lessons or piano lessons. And she chose the ballet lessons and gave up after 6 weeks and regretted it forever. And she's always, her life would have been so different, and who knows what she, but I think she was determined that as long as I was interested in the guitar, then she was determined to support it. So incredibly lucky. I was incredibly lucky.
That's so beautiful.
And then I went to a school where I was told that when you do the careers advice thing, and they said, what do you want to do? And I said, I'd like to be a musician. And they thought that was hilarious. And they said, well, the only way we can see that happening is if you join the Royal Marines and join their band, which I'm sure that's a lovely way to, a lovely path into music, but I would not be suited to a life in the Royal Marines by any stretch. So I didn't do that. And instead, my local sort of high school started doing a special course in music technology, the first time it had ever run. And I was really lucky that I went on and did that. And I learned lots of programming and sampling and sequencing and how to use back then multi-track tape recorders and that kind of thing before the days of sort of pre-digital days. So I was really lucky to have that opportunity as well. So I really have sort of walked on golden air my whole life, and none of it's all luck rather than judgment. I've just been an incredibly lucky person.
I think it's an interesting, I don't know that it's luck. I think that if you see the beauty in something, and that if that calls to you, and it sounds like you've had a calling your whole life, really, something that's really resonated with you. And so I think that the universe kind of works to set that in place and, you know, pass you this really nice, these opportunities that, because it's something that you love, you picked up on and you know, grabbed with your whole heart. And I think that that's so beautiful that it's become such a enormous part of who you are in your life. It's incredible.
Yeah. And yeah, no, I agree. And I like that very much. And I do think that I hope that I appreciate the opportunities that I've been given. There was a time when I did music for a job as well. So before I was doing kind of animation workshops, I was doing music workshops. And I would do drumming and junk percussion and sort of adaptive technology for people with quite severe disability. So using music technology to enable people with physical limitations to play music, possibly for the first time, and I did really enjoy that, and I did sort of songwriting sessions and recording sessions and things like that, and I suddenly realized that I hadn't played any music for me for about 4 years, and I didn't pick up a guitar, I didn't do any of those sort of things that I'd done all my life, and I was making films as a hobby, and it suddenly dawned on me that was all wrong. And it'd be much better to do the film as a job if possible. And I was so much happier. Just it put all the love and the joy back into music, which some of which had gone. So I think I've never wanted it to be my job since then, you know. That's why I'm not famous, see?
I think that's so beautiful, though, because it gives you a little bit more freedom, a little bit more playfulness and silliness. And, you know, it can be a little bit more fun rather than, you know, being a job.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely. You know, it's great to have a job, and obviously I'm lucky to have one, but it can take the joy out of something you really do love. If suddenly you've got expectations and deadlines and people, you know, sort of relying on you to do such and such by such and such, and then suddenly it's not good enough. And the idea of music not being good enough, I think, is quite horrific, because if you mean it and you believe in it, then how can it not be good enough? There's a thing, I this might be a problematic thing to say, but we moved to Wales, where there is a culture of competitive music. They have a competition locally and nationally called Eisteddfod, where children and adults compete to see who can sing a song the best, or who can play the flute the best, or who can recite a poem the best, or who can paint a picture the best. And you get first, second and third, and everything else is worthless. So if you go up, you stand on a stage in front of however many people, you sing your little heart out, and you don't come third, second or third, what's the point? Why did you do it? Because you didn't win anything. And I find that absolutely horrific. I find it horrible. I don't see how you can take pleasure in that. Even if you win, great, you're the best singer. What does it mean? What does that mean? It doesn't mean anything.
That can be something that really crushes your inclination towards something creative, if you're, you know, if it does feel like you've you know, you're not good enough, so why do it?
And I mean, when, but it doesn't seem to apply to real life either. Do you know what I mean? Mick Jagger doesn't go around singing, "Yeah, I'm the best singer that ever was. I'm definitely the best singer." It just, you sing because you have to sing and because it's a part of you.
Yeah.
And who cares if you win? Who cares if you lose? Who cares if you sound awful? It doesn't matter. If it's a part of you, then that's the best thing ever. Oh dear, I've gone on a rant. I'm sorry about that.
It's absolutely incredible. That's, you know, that's what the podcast is all about, is getting to that, you know, authentic expression of how you view the world, really. What does self-love mean for you?
I think it's an interesting one, isn't it? It's that kind of balance between just having a sense of worth and value. Sorry, I don't know what that was. Without getting all the way to kind of arrogance. I guess it's something else. I think it is just about realizing your uniqueness and the astronomical odds against anything as magnificent as each human being ever happening mean that there's no one out there who doesn't have a huge amount of value to the world, to themselves, to their family. It's about that realization, I think. And as soon as you have that, I think you're all right. But it's hard to keep hold of, isn't it, when life throws you balls of shit, you've just got to kind of remember. There's that horrible American video, but it's really good. A man offers somebody a $20 bill. And he says, "Would you like this $20 bill?" And the person says, "Yes, please." And then they crunch it into a ball and they say, "Would you still like this $20 bill?" And they go, "Yes, I still do." And as they throw it on the ground and they stamp on it and they scrunch it all up with their foot and they say, "Would you still like that $20 bill?" And the person says, "Yes, I'd still like the $20 bill." Because it still has value, even no matter what's happened to it, no matter what someone has chosen to do to it to try and destroy it, it still has value. And I quite like the analogy, even though it's a bit cheesy, but I do think everyone has that value and is important to the universe. And if you can remember that, then I think that will help you to love yourself.
That's a really nice visual image. I'm such a visual person, so it's really nice because, yeah, it's like this unconditional worthiness that, you know, it doesn't change no matter what happens, or, you know, if you're even, you know, if you're broken or, you know, been through trauma or anything like that, like you're still a being made of the stuff of stars and still have intrinsic, you know, everything's connected. So everything has intrinsic, you know, relations to everything else. And I think that, yeah, that's a really nice explanation of it for sure. And yeah, there's something about the arrogance in there, like staying humble, but also, you know, knowing that.
I think the key in, well, not the key necessarily, but I think a way of looking at it is you are that person and you are that valuable and you are that significant to the universe, but so is the person next to you. And so is that person that you struggle to get on with or you disagree with, but they are also of massive significance to the world. And I think if you can bear that in mind as well, that should, in theory, temper the kind of the arrogance. I think the problem starts when you start thinking that you are worth more than anyone.
Yeah.
So you are incredible, but you are not more incredible than your next door neighbor or whoever else.
That's funny in terms of like the music competition and that as well. That's interesting. And maybe that's the basis of empathy, right? Recognizing that although each of our experiences is unique, everybody else's is unique as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
You've expressed like a love of working with tactile analog creative methods to me before. So can you tell me what's drawn you to a digital dropout way of being?
I can tell you where the name came from. That might be a good way to start. So when I was, the way I got into film, I went to work for an organization as a musician, and the music project kind of ended, but they had all this film equipment that they bought for a project. And this was back when you had to spend like a lot of money to the idea of editing video. You had to spend out a lot of money to make that happen. And they had this equipment and it had been sat there in this arts organization's basement for however many years. And they said, well, you can just go off and learn to use that if you like. And this was pre kind of, I expect there were forums and chat rooms and places where sort of people making films could discuss stuff, but I didn't have access to it. But there was a person sort of a few offices down who had been making films, and I was making a music video as a just a project, and there were these little white blocks on the screen, and I just thought they were so cool. They just appeared out of nowhere, and I couldn't work out what they were, but I thought they were really cool. And so I went and found this guy and I brought him in and said, what are those? And he said, oh, it's dropout from the digital tape. I said, what's that mean? And he said, well, it's missing information. You've recorded these images, but the tape's corrupted or warped or crinkled or something. And it's trying to find little bits of information that aren't there. And I thought, oh, so it's like digital dropout. And that's kind of where it came from. But I thought these little blocks were the best thing about this video. And I wanted more of them. So the idea of the stuff around the edges. So I do have to use computers and I do have to use digital cameras to be able to do everything that I do, or a lot of the workshops I do now, I use iPads and tablets and that kind of thing. But I love actual real things moving. And if you set a character draw a circle and you want that to move across the screen in a straight line, so you can do that digitally and you can set, you know, keyframe here, at this point you will be here on the screen, and then half a second later you'll be over there, and you can set that digitally and it will go in a lovely smooth straight line and it will look cold and boring. Or you can draw a circle and then you can rub it out and draw another circle, and you can rub it out and draw another circle, and you can make exactly the same thing happen, but it's so much more human, and it's so much, it means to me so much more when it's a real thing moving than when it's zeros and ones just causing something to move. And so I think quite a lot of what I do looks a bit like kind of cheap computer animation, but it's done with paper. And it is real things. And when something moves, we're moving it. We actually, you know, a human has had to go, just nudge it along a little bit to make it move. And it's that stuff, that humanization, that, like you said, the analogness of creating stuff, especially moving stuff and sound stuff and that kind of thing. I love all that. I really do. And in making music as well, again, I have to use a computer, but I try and use kind of, if I'm playing live, I won't use a computer. I've got a very old sort of mid-90s sequencer, and that does all my, that does all the sort of MIDI stuff and the synthy stuff. And then I've got a sampler that I can play in things that I've actually played, and guitar lines and ukulele lines that I've actually played, and they sound a little bit shaky and the timing's not great and that kind of thing. But I'd much rather that than have pure digital quantized perfection. Mm-hmm. As a, I'm my, my favorite Brian Eno quote, and there are hundreds, but it is when something distorts or it goes wrong or it makes a noise that you weren't expecting, what you're hearing is the inability of the technology to capture the human emotion. So when you record something into a microphone and the microphone suddenly distorts, that's the technology not being able to keep up with your emotion. And I like that very much. I think that's a lovely way of looking at it. So it's not wrong and it's not bad. It's not done in the wrong way. It's you're better than a computer.
It's got this warmth to it. I mean, you know, like you're saying, like with cold, almost sterile, like a, you can get a computer generated drum beat and it's soulless. So I really like that idea of, keeping the life alive in something that, you know, could very easily become, you know, a computer, or, you know, like you say, like ones and zeros. It brings life back into it and keeps that life going, and yeah, adds a lot of warmth. I don't know, it's just got it really resonates with me because it does feel more authentic, like everything, you know, musically and animation wise that you do, like it's true and whole. And you know, like when you see these paper animations moving, I know that you've had to go in and shift them around, and it adds so much more appreciation, I think, for the time and the energy and the emotion that goes into it.
I hope so. It's a lovely thing to say. I've never sort of, I don't know. I do strive for authenticity over technicality, I think. Oh, can you hear that train?
Is that a train?
That's a train just there. We have trains at the bottom of the garden. I would say that authenticity, particularly kind of emotional authenticity, is much more important than technical smoothness and perfection. Mm. And I think that applies to everything, really, in life. I think whatever you do, if you mean it, then it is of massive value to you, regardless of what anyone else thinks. I've never particularly had an audience, but I love what I love doing what I do, and I get so much out of it.
I mean, everything you make, from animations to music to even cocktails, is full of this like whimsical energy that really gets me excited about being creative. What inspires you?
Crikey, all kinds of stuff. I mean, I love there's so much to see out there, and there's so much sort of there's things that you never think about. And I'm lucky that my job means that I do get to think about things sometimes. Like these carers stories. There's so many people doing incredible things. And finding one of the questions that they're being asked. So these are people in a position of care with massive amounts of responsibility. And one of the questions they're asked is, what are the joys of being a carer? How do you take joy in your role caring for another human being? And sometimes when you're listening back to what they say, you think they possibly have never, either they've never been asked that question or they've never sort of stopped to think about it. And they suddenly realize, well, actually, when my son just says thank you, he just says thank you because I've done something that he can't do for himself. And you can hear it in their voice. That's why I do it. That's why I do this day after day after day, is these tiny little bubbles. And that's what makes it all worthwhile. So I'm very lucky. I've always been lucky in my job that I've worked with people who are sort of outside the mainstream. So my early work in community arts was all sort of people with disabilities, often sort of learning disabilities. And then I moved to Doncaster and I worked for an organization there who were just fearless in who they would work with. And I was a little bumpkin from the island. I didn't know anything about anyone. And suddenly I was working with sort of probation service and horrific offenders and sex workers and sort of addicts in and out of recovery. And sort of just getting the opportunity to engage with these people on a level where I am one human, you are another human. Let's just work it out. You know, let's just, what do you want to do? And how can we make that happen? So I think, it's a long-winded way of saying it, but I think what inspires me is people, is human beings, and just what their stories and what's going on for them, and what their realities are like, and what their day-to-day stuff, and the sheer fact that they keep on just being people, no matter what happens, no matter what sort of medical, criminal, legal things happen, they just keep being the people that they're being, and I love those stories, and I love sort of being allowed to tell them. What inspires the cocktails? I don't know, really. I just like things that are delicious. I like the showiness of it. I like the fact that you take something that is a drink. I mean, you have a drink, a glass of water, a cup of tea. You drink is a prosaic thing that you do 8 or 9 times a day. But if you take one of those drinks, it doesn't have to be an alcoholic drink, but you take one of those drinks and you just take a little bit of time on it, and you choose the ingredients that go into it with care, and you take a bit of time to make sure that it's very, very cold and it's really well mixed, and then you decorate that, you garnish it with fruit or edible flowers or leaves or something. You just take a bit of time to make that one drink really special. And I think you appreciate it a lot more. And certainly the people that you then give that drink to, they see the kind of love that you've put into that, and they really do appreciate it. And especially with a mixed drink. So a drink that has elements that combine to make something else. And sometimes they mix. Some drinks are very, when you've put them together, they form a whole that is a mix. And sometimes they are layered. So sometimes they are, you can taste such and such, then such and such, then such and such, then such and such. And sometimes the flavor just boom hits you all at once. I find that really interesting as well. And just the fact that there's so much. I have a book with 2,000 different cocktails in it, and I'm slowly working my way through it. There's no sort of idea of getting to the end of it, but it never gets boring. There's always something new.
I love how much joy you find in other people, and then, you know, that inspires you to keep creating, to keep bringing that joy and recognizing it in others. It's such a genuinely wholesome way of being.
I hope so. It's not altruism, though. I take a lot of pleasure in it myself. I do, you know, and I enjoy feedback. I enjoy, you know, when people say that was delicious, or I enjoyed watching that, or, you know, I was dancing around the kitchen listening to such and such. I love all that. I think I get a lot out of it as well. It's not a selfless act. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, it feeds you at the same time.
Totally.
What are some of the biggest life lessons you've learned?
I mean, I don't claim to have anything right, but obviously I'm bringing up, Rosie and I are bringing up two new human beings, and we're trying to make sure that they interpret the world in a way that makes them happy. So I guess you've got to learn something along the way, haven't you? I think I've only ever been at one point in my life when I was really desperately situationally unhappy, and I had an awful job, and it was my first job after leaving university. And one day it just hit me, you don't have to do this to yourself. You can change that. And as a result of changing that job, I ended up kind of leaving a town, leaving a relationship, but it was the job really that I was mainly dissatisfied with. But in order to do that, I had to change quite a lot of things around me. And I did, and it all worked out sort of well. But I do believe that dissatisfaction is worth listening to. It's a worthwhile motivation to actually do something, to change something. Obviously, there are things in your life that you can't change. But I think if you can, even if it's difficult, you should. If you are really unhappy with a situation, and you have the power, even if it's hard, even if it's really, really hard, you have the power to change it, I think you should. Maybe that's not really a lesson. I mean,
I think that's
I have been incredibly lucky, but I've always strived to do the things that make me happy. And I've been lucky enough that people have been able to pay me for it.
Yeah, definitely. Adds some incentive, doesn't it?
yeah. But part of that is I do think having a good if somebody asks you to do something, and especially if they're paying you for it, you do need to do a really good job of it and make sure that they're happy. Crap. But I've been lucky, but I do take pride in what I do as well. I do finish things off.
Mm.
But yeah. Try and especially with creative stuff. And I came to the realization in my early 20s that I was never going to make any money out of music. So why be in a band that you don't like? And why play songs that you don't like? Or why be in a band with people that you don't particularly like? If you're not, you may as well enjoy it. If you're not going to make any money at it, then just do the thing that really makes you happy.
Mm-hmm. I like that as a direction, like a guiding kind of factor. When you find yourself in a place where you're not enjoying, or not being able to be your whole being. I mean, that's my big one is, if something's making you feel like a lesser version of yourself, stop doing it. Basically, and constantly chasing that. Well, chasing sounds like you never get it, but following the things that make you joyous, really.
Absolutely.
And it's never gonna lead you wrong. I don't think you're only gonna get more joy.
my granddad was a dairy farmer, stockman dairy farmer. He worked with cows, and he once said he'd never had a bad day at work. And he came back and I said, have you had a nice day at work? He said, I never had a bad day. He loved it. He loved what he did. He loved cows. He loved being responsible for them and looking after them, and that was all he wanted to do. But he never had a bad day at work. Imagine that. Never, just because he was doing what he loved. I think that's awesome.
That's so nice.
Yeah.
And to be able to find that level of I guess it's happiness. There might be another word that's almost like happiness always sounds, maybe contentment possibly.
I think it's somewhere there, isn't it? It's sort of fulfillment. And
yeah. Yeah.
Either you learn to appreciate, you learn to find it in what you happen to be doing. And if you can't, then you should probably be doing something else.
I think that's a good way of whittling it down. What do you think it means to be a grown-up? And do you feel like one?
Oh, yes and no. I mean, I feel a lot more relaxed in myself than I did when I was a kid, particularly in my teenage years. I found I found adolescence very, very stressful, and I wouldn't go through that again for love nor money. And there's a certain I don't know what the word is, maybe it is fulfillment again, but there's a certain calmness that comes with being older that I think is a wonderful thing. But that doesn't necessarily mean you have to be more serious. Mm-hmm. And I certainly would hope that you never lose that playfulness. That's the thing. I mean, you're responsible when you're a grown up, in inverted commas. You are responsible. I'm responsible for making sure that my kids are okay and making sure that they're fed and happy and dry and warm and comfy. But you can enjoy that as well. That's a huge source of pleasure, the fact that you're able to do it, or that you do it to the best of your ability. I think, so as well as being a responsibility, that's a privilege, and one that I love. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably the most grown-up-ish thing I've ever done, really, is decide to have, or, you know, be part of a family, a new family.
Mm. I mean, something that's always stood out to me about you and Rosie is the way that you speak with and support both Bess and Nancy, your kids. Do you have any philosophies that you guys really value as parents that you kind of try and carry through?
I would never claim to know the answers there. I'm lucky. We are lucky. We like our, you know, we've got a lot of time and respect for our kids. I enjoy their company. I do just genuinely like hanging out with them. It could have gone completely the other way. They might be little horrors. There's a point when they become capable of rational thought. The first few years are a bit tricky because they can't, you can't have necessarily a reasoned conversation with them because everything is a sort of an immediate level. But as soon as, I think with both of them, train. Let that go. I think with both our daughters, I think it happened around 3 or 4, where suddenly they could see the logic to what you were saying. So when you said, look, it's really not a good idea to do such and such because it will lead to such and such. And as soon as they're old enough to really get that, from that point on, everything's a lot easier because as long as you're rational, and as long as you never kind of say, because I said so, as long as you can provide a reasonable reason why they shouldn't do, you know, don't eat all those sweets because you will be sick, or, you know, don't throw rocks at the dog because the dog will bite you. As soon as that's there, it all gets a lot easier. And I think, I hope that sort of leads to a bit more mutual respect on both sides. But also be prepared to listen to a rational argument from them. For example, both our girls had wanted a pet for a very long time. And we tried various things. And one day Rosie and I were called into the living room where the kids had written out a blackboard with a 5-point proposal on why they should be allowed to have some fish. And they took it in turns to read out the different points that they'd written. It was illustrated with pictures of fish, and we should be allowed to have a fish because such and such. And not, we hadn't said, look, if you want a fish, you're going to have to come up with a reason why you should be allowed to have a fish. They just, could you come and, And so we got fish because they clearly thought it through. They had it all sort of planned out very, very, very constructively. And so, yeah, we got a fish, or several.
I love that. I really resonate with that because that's something I used to do as a kid. If my parents, you know, had kind of like laid down the law on something, I would spend some time and I would make up, you know, like a little A4 poster of a bunch of drawings and like, this is why you're wrong and this is why, you know, this is why I should be able to do this or get this or, you know, all of that. And it was always, I'd never really had like a presentation of it though. I would always like sneakily slip it under their door so they would see okay. it first thing in the morning. But I really like that. And yeah, there's this like almost not reversal in roles, but this, you know, I guess like being able to express and rationalize, you know, the things. And I think it's lovely that it can be a conversation and that it can be, you know, it's not just you lording over the kids. It's, you know, it's a relationship and it goes both Absolutely. Ways. Sometimes the roles get reversed and that's weird. And they end up teaching you stuff or.
Gosh, yes, all the time. No, absolutely. But I think you've got to be prepared to say, and especially if you do, because you do make mistakes and you do, I don't know, accuse somebody of doing something and they haven't done it. And I think you've got to be prepared to go, oh, crikey, I'm really sorry. I thought you'd done that. Obviously you haven't. I apologize. Next time I'll try not to jump to conclusions, which that tends to be my relationship with Nancy quite a lot. I do sometimes leap to, if all the biscuits have gone, I was like, Nancy, have you eaten all the biscuits? No, I have not eaten all the biscuits. And we find out all the biscuits were eaten, but not by Nancy.
Rosie's in the corner wiping the crumbs off her mouth.
Probably me, actually. More likely, I've eaten all the biscuits and can't remember doing it.
Is there anything that like you really hope that they'll kind of reflect on their childhood and think about you guys? You know, like any overarching themes that'll really stand out for them that you guys try and...
I hope they'll feel that they were listened to, just sort of following on from what we said. I hope that they will feel that they were part of running this family by consensus, really, and that they were that everything that we have done was done with their not consent, but that they were in favour of. And maybe that's not what I mean. I know we moved house, and I know that my eldest daughter was not massively happy about it, but we still did it. I think in hindsight, she would see why we did. But it's possible now that she's that bit older, I think she would be more involved in that decision-making process. I think they both would. If we were to consider something like that again, I do hope that we would sort of have a lot more consultation, a lot more consideration.
Yeah.
I hope they remember that they were happy, and I hope that they remember that we did sort of fun stuff and that we had time for them. We're very lucky, Rosie and I, in our jobs, let us spend quite a lot of time with our kids and go and do stuff.
Mm.
We've never had a huge amount of money, but we have always had enough time, I think.
I think that's, you know, that's all you really can ask. I don't know. I mean, what is money except a value put on, you know, time that you've given to maybe someone else or something else? And so I think that it's a really nice balance, and that you guys just have this flow as a family unit that, you know, is really... admirable sounds like the wrong word again, but I don't know, inspirational a little bit.
That's a very nice thing to say. We do genuinely enjoy the time that we have together, and I think that all began with Rosie and I. Really, we were best friends for 10 years before we got together, so we are still that doesn't just change just because you get married. She's still absolutely my best friend. Then you bring kids in, and it's two best friends bringing up kids, and that's even better, you know. That's what more could you want?
They're just littler friends.
Yeah, smaller friends, tiny little friends.
Do you have any suggestions for people who are maybe, you know, feeling that little bit of stuckness or taking life a little too seriously or just like having a hard time bringing silliness back into their lives?
I don't know. I mean, you know, everyone's got to live their own way, haven't they? I would suggest if you've got no fun in your life or not enough, I would just suggest you reflect on what is possibly at stake for you in doing something silly. What would you have to lose by doing something frivolous or silly, something that doesn't cost you any money, doesn't waste any of your time. In fact, maybe no one's even going to see, but you paint a picture, or you draw something, or you sit down with a sheet of paper, you cover the whole thing in something, felt tip, Tipex, paint, stickers, anything. You just do that, and nobody cares, nobody's watching, but I reckon you'll enjoy it. And I think you should just consider what possible risk is there to you in doing something silly. Obviously, if that's parkour on a dangerous building or something, then obviously there is quite a strong risk. But if it is just, if you're worried about creative risk, what could possibly go wrong? What harm could come to you from doing it? Put a mix on SoundCloud, do something, just make something, draw something, build something, take a photo of it, post it on something. And if you're worried about what your friends are going to think, then don't post it there. Post it on a group for people that build stuff. Mm-hmm. Whatever you want to do, there are other people that want to do it as well. And go and find them and go and share, especially now. You've got access to communities of people doing, you know, balancing coins one on top of each other, you know, on their sides. I bet there's a website dedicated to that. And if you want to do it, find them and just share it with them. Find the people that want to do what you want to do. It sounds really easy, doesn't it? I don't know if it is that easy, but, or don't share it. Just enjoy it. Just enjoy what you did. Look back at what you did and think, oh, that was fun. I'll do that again. I'll do it better. I'll do it bigger. I'll do more. I'll spend longer on it.
I think that's really nice in a way, because so often like a community can, it kind of works a little bit like a echo chamber, like the sound, you know, like reverberates of your, you know, you putting that energy and everything out in that form. And then when you have a community that supports that, you know, it just keeps building. And yeah. And that level of support, I think, can be really powerful. I mean, that's what kind of started the zine, started the podcast, started, you know, making comics and stuff like that, is that, you know, if I can act as a little bit of that echo chamber, and if people are, you know, creating things, putting things out, and then all you need is sometimes just a little spark of support or encouragement, or, you know, even if it's from yourself, I think silencing that voice that is like, that's not what adults do.
Yeah. Or what if somebody doesn't like it? So what? What if somebody doesn't like it? Did you like it? Then it's worth it.
Yeah.
I love Growing Pains. I think it's a wonderful thing. And I think it's a really, I think it's a great platform for just people to say what they want to say. And I think that's a jolly fine thing.
I don't know if we get that space that often to just, you know, have conversations like this and reflect on I mean, kind of like what you were saying with the conversation with the carers, like, well, if no one asks those questions, do you ever reflect on what brings you joy?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
I think it's time as well. I think they're so frantically busy just surviving that sometimes maybe they just don't see or don't have the chance to see that what they're doing is amazing. They're superheroes, and they are, you know, they should take pride. Every night when they go to sleep, they should just be proud of what they did to just keep going, keep that unerring love for someone else going for another day, even when it's really flipping difficult. Mm-hmm. Just be massively proud of that.
Do you have any kind of final thoughts on any of the things that we've talked about?
I've really enjoyed it. It's felt a bit indulgent. I'm not used to sort of talking about myself. It's really, I'd be lying if I said I didn't enjoy it. No, just thank you. Thank you for the chance to have a sort of creative conversation. It's lovely.
Yeah, it's really nice to hear about, you know, like the building of your roots as this creative emotional being. So I really thank you for being so open and sharing so much of what's made you the person, creator, mixologist, animator, parent, music, one man band that you are. Is there anything that you would like to plug at the end, anywhere we can find all of your lovely things?
I'm going to be putting all the carers films on my Digital Dropout Media Facebook page at some point. I'm just sort of working out permissions there. I think it'd be nice if they got a wider audience and just people sort of, especially the people that had put their voices to it, got to hear what people thought. I think that'd be a lovely thing. There's Jimmy Tooties is on Facebook and YouTube. There's a YouTube channel for Jimmy Tooties, the Vicarious Cocktail Bar. I don't need an audience. I really don't. I just like doing what I'm doing.
I think that really resonates in everything you do at the same time, which I think is amazing. So it's like, it's joyous to hear and see everything that you create because you get so much joy out of it.
I do. I really do. I wouldn't do it if I didn't. I wouldn't see the point. I think, if it's not fun or worth something, then I don't think anyone should do anything. No, I'm not sure if I stand by that, actually. But obviously there are things that are not necessarily either. But I do think you should look for the joy in everything.
And now here's Gonna Fly by Jim's one-man band, Jimsomniac. I'm not afraid to Thank you.